right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a hell of a show for you today. It's going to be really interesting, and it's going to scare the hell out of you. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Orpheus Reed, writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we're going to be talking about what's happening at Porter Ranch and all that methane that's leaking into the air. What's it actually signify, and what's the importance of people paying attention to it right now, and how does it fit in with the agreement that was made in Paris that was going to make everything okay? Yeah, we'll see about that. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased about this segment, all right? We're going to be talking with Suzanne Rust. Suzanne is the project director for the Energy and Environmental Reporting Project at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. And she has been neck deep in carrying out an investigative campaign around ExxonMobil and its campaign to prevent people from learning about and knowing about the dangers of climate change. Suzanne Rust, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Suzanne, let me ask you to begin with. You were deeply involved in this whole exploration of Exxon and what the hell it was doing in relation to climate change back in the 80s, the 90s, and all the way through up until today. Now, one of the things in this project that you were working on, there was a statement that was made that Exxon went from leader to skeptic on climate change. Explain what you're talking about there, because from what I've read, it was not so innocent. It wasn't so innocent as a simple and honest shift into skepticism. Like, well, we discovered something that really made us think twice about this. So what was it, Exxon going from leader to skeptic?
So we found some documents at the University of Texas that sort of outlined all of this, because when we began doing our research into this investigation, we started looking for published papers that Exxon had written about climate change, and we actually found quite a lot. They were sponsoring climate change meetings at Columbia University, for instance, in the early 1980s. They were funding researchers, and they seemed, unlike any other oil company, really sort of out in the front, examining, investigating, trying to figure out what was going on. It was clear that carbon dioxide was increasing in the atmosphere. It was clear there was a tie to human activity, but what was that going to do? And then at some point in the late 1980s, according to the documents we found, they made a shift. And that shift went from sort of embracing this science to suddenly asking for more time, emphasizing doubt about the science. And from talks with sources and engineers who had worked for the company, in fact, to the former advisor or their former senior climate science researcher, things changed because of policy. So the science was always very clear to them, but the policy ramifications became quite large in the late 1980s. And if you sort of go back in time and remember what was happening then, that was when Jim Hansen got up in front of Congress during one of the most sweltering summers on the East Coast and said, with 99% certainty, climate change was happening and was going to affect the future temperature of the globe. Time magazine put climate change on its front cover. People were just sort of beginning to discuss this, and it was really becoming apparent to Exxon and to other oil companies that this was not just interesting science issue to examine and to discover, but really could have severe policy implications and also financial implications for the company if regulations were enacted that would curb carbon dioxide emissions or cut carbon dioxide emissions. And so they made this, what it looks like through these documents, a very apparent decision to change from let's investigate this to let's question this in public. And it's also at the time that they began to fund organizations that advocated skepticism and doubt.
Okay. So we'll explore a little bit of this as we go along. And I wanted to particularly, I mean, everything you mentioned there is something I really wanted to dig into. So the first thing is, just to be clear now, so people understand that when they made that shift from being the leader in investigating what's going on with the climate, the impact of carbon dioxide and the rest of this on the planet, and all these other things going on, they actually were rooted in science. It was not like sort of half science and sort of half trickery or something. It was actually, they understood clearly what was the threat, what were the repercussions of global warming, the causes and repercussions. But they actually made a decision to, it seems like, and from what I've read there, they made a decision that was rooted firmly in, well, let's be reasonable. It was sort of almost like something that Mr. Burns on The Simpsons would say. You know, well, yes, climate change could kill us all, but let's think about our bottom line. Let's think about our profit margin, which seems to be a big part of what was actually motivating them.
So obviously, I don't work at Exxon, so I can't tell you what the motivation was. But it is clear, and let me back up here, ExxonMobil is now one of the largest corporations on the planet, and they've gotten to this point because They are really good at what they do, and their scientists are top-notch. I mean, if you go back to the early 1980s, late 1970s, I mean, Exxon was like, I'd like to sort of describe it as this renaissance company. They hired the best and the brightest out of PhD programs across the country, and they were doing cutting-edge research. So science was never a problem, right? They knew exactly what was going on. But there was always a question, and there is always a question, of what exactly is going to happen, right? Researchers make these models to sort of predict the temperature is going to rise by this much, sea level is going to rise. But they are just sort of projections and predictions into the future, and they're not with 100% certainty. You know, it could rise by 6 degrees, it could rise by 2 degrees. It was in the late 1980s that Exxon sort of went from this, at least publicly, from this message of, you know, things could change, there is a problem here, too. Hey, we really don't know what's going to happen. Let's not make any rash decisions here. Let's, like, hold back. Let's see what happens, and then we can start making decisions. And so it's sort of like a nuanced change, but it was a significant change. The critics will tell you it sort of set the pattern or the foundation for where we are today, that there was sort of a rallying cry in the late 1980s about we need to do something. And companies like Exxon, Koch Industries, began to emphasize this, we really don't know what's going to happen, so let's not make a decision now. And that has sort of polarized not only the public's opinion of climate change, but politicians, and therefore the laws, the regulations, the policies around it.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the reasons I'm kind of pursuing this a little bit more is because it is kind of, it's really, one, it's disturbing and it's enraging to a certain extent, where you have actually a company that had the ability to and had been looking into this on a very serious level and understood what the repercussions of what was being done in the industry that they were one of the main forces in. They said, I think the quote I had around this was that they actually decided that the efforts to reduce the known impact of climate change would profoundly impact the strategic direction of the energy industry. And they were really much more concerned about that. What did they mean it would impact the strategic direction of the energy industry?
So I'm not entirely sure, but my understanding of what that means is that the strategic decision of the energy industry was, let's get more oil, let's get more gas, let's sell more, right? Let's grow, like, wherever we can. And if regulations on carbon dioxide emissions or fossil fuel use were enacted, that would really change the business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was afraid of. So I had a sense of that. Well, let's talk about this. There was a draft memo that appeared in August 1988 called the Greenhouse Effect, and it actually unveiled something known as the Exxon position. Can you go into a little bit? I know you started to talk about this. Can you go a little bit more into that? What exactly was that?
So that is a draft document that we discovered in these archives. Again, it was never a document that was published by the company. It wasn't an approved document that was, like, circulated within the company. But it was made by the head of public relations at the time, at least in corporate research, and presumably was circulated among some. We could never get the full story about it. But in any case, the draft document sort of laid out what the concerns about climate change were. It went carefully through, here's the science, here's what we know. We know there's scientific consensus around this, but there are concerns about what could happen if regulations are enacted. And what it concluded with was what the Exxon position would be. You know, this is how the company should deal with climate change going forward. And the first item under that was emphasize the uncertainty and scientific conclusions regarding the potential enhanced greenhouse effect, and urge a balanced scientific approach. You know, whether or not that was the document that was then circulated to the whole company or public, it does seem to parallel or sort of lay out how the company behaved going forward and what the message they used was going forward.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Suzanne Rust, the project director of the Energy and Environmental Reporting Project at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. And we're talking about a recent series of investigative articles that Suzanne and other people from the Columbia School of Journalism did in relation to ExxonMobil and its conscious attempts to hide the impact of global warming and to cover it all up and to just go on ahead with destroying the planet. Well, just so people can understand this, let's explore this a little bit more. This emphasize the doubt. What did it look like in action, actually?
The emphasize the doubt?
Yeah.
Again, it was sort of really sort of hitting home on this idea of the models that we use to project what the greenhouse effect is going to do to the planet in terms of sea levels, temperatures, is uncertain. So let's emphasize that uncertainty, because for all we know, nothing could happen. And again, we don't want the government or any governments to like proactively reduce the emissions of carbon dioxide or the use of fossil fuels for something we're not certain about.
Mm-hmm.
And that was their position. And if you go and look at advertisements by the companies at that time, particularly leading up to Kyoto, that position is seen over and over and over again. Mobil Oil, for instance, had a advertisement, I think it was every Tuesday, I could be wrong, but it might have been every Thursday, in the New York Times on the op-ed page. And they would have periods of time where they put in advertisements about climate change. And this was the message that was provided over and over. There's a lot of uncertainty, so let's not do anything rash.
Mm-hmm. What was the Global Climate Coalition, and what was the impact of that?
The Global Climate Coalition started in the late 1980s, and again, it was during this period, right after the Jim Hansen testimony, right when everybody seemed to be rallying behind this idea of climate change and getting concerned about what could happen to the planet. And a bunch of, my understanding is, coal companies got together and said, something needs to be done about this. We can't let this environmental movement do anything that could impact our company. And in the early 1990s, the Global Climate Coalition reached out to the American Petroleum Institute, which is the trade group of the oil companies, and said they needed money, and they thought they had a common position on this. And so at that point, a bunch of companies from the American Petroleum Institute came on board, and that would include like Exxon and Mobil and Shell. And what they did was they created a campaign to emphasize, again, this uncertainty, this doubt, and to try to get into public perception that this climate change business was not a scientific consensus, that it really could all be a hoax. And so they created advertisements. They worked with public relations firms to try to get this message out there.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things is, and it's really interesting in this, and it's sort of, while they were doing all this, and they themselves were, you know, while they were actually doing this, you don't really know what's going to happen. Understanding that they actually did have at least somewhat, and it seems like a pretty deep understanding of what the danger of not dealing with climate change was, and then what was happening by the kind of work that they were doing in terms of carbon dioxide and the global warming and the repercussions of that, even if they didn't understand it all the way out. But at the same time as they were saying, really, don't worry about this that much, or just saying it's too early to do anything. I mean, one thing that was really kind of, for me, it was just really aggravating. It was really kind of like, are you kidding me? Where they said, actually, they made this point about, to the people, that, well, your life is going to have to change to a certain extent. This idea of you're going to have to sacrifice, we're going to have to sacrifice. If we just pursue ahead willy-nilly and take this, like, you know, this idea that there's climate change and we're contributing to this, that your life is going to have to change. It's not going to be any good for the standard of living of the people, and it's not going to be any good for the margins, the profit margins and whatnot, and the ability of these corporations to continue to give you the standard of living you're used to, which was a really, there's something really annoying or, you know, enraging about that, in terms of, really, it's your fault and you really have to, you know, you really have to go along with this on this because we're pursuing your best interests.
That was a message that was repeated over and over again also. And the Global Climate Coalition was one of the angles that they were most interested in sort of promoting, that a cut in fossil fuels, again, a cut in carbon dioxide emissions, would affect a standard of living. And that the economic ramifications and the standard of living ramifications would be huge for something that they were saying was not fully understood. And so, yeah, that was something that was said over and over again. And another angle that was often used by the companies was, listen, here in the Western world, we can, you know, cut back on emissions and we can make these regulations, but who is to deprive developing countries from the ability to access energy? In a sense, they turned the argument in such a way that it would almost be immoral to cut back on carbon dioxide emissions and fossil fuel use because it would be depriving so much of the world from being able to develop into, to have a standard of living like, you know, the Western world.
Right.
Yeah. So that was another interesting area. But keep in mind, you know, that as they were saying this, one of the things we really focused on in this investigation was inside the companies, they were actually taking heed of climate change projections and incorporating them into their own engineering designs. So as they were saying, hey, this is really uncertain, we shouldn't be doing anything rash here, we shouldn't be changing anything as a result of something that's so uncertain, internally, they were certain enough that they were spending, you know, millions of dollars to develop engineering and infrastructure designs that would account for climate change.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Suzanne Rust. Suzanne is the project director of the Energy and Environmental Reporting Project at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. And we're talking about the efforts of ExxonMobil to cover up the impact of global warming as they pushed ahead and tried to, well, basically rape the planet. I'm so glad you went there, because that's exactly what my next question was going to be, is that, you know, they were doing all kinds of things that actually was based on their understanding that this stuff was real, it was happening, and they had to deal with it. But even then, and it was kind of heavy, because even then they were looking at two things. I mean, actually, I thought it was very, very, it was kind of funny but scary at the same time when they said this thing about, well, we're doing all this, but then they went out and they said, you know, look, let's raise those platforms that we're building in the ocean. Let's raise them, oh, I don't know, a couple of meters, okay? And it's like, they knew, so this point about what they were doing to prepare for this, for the what they knew was a pretty inevitable, in a certain sense, you know, although inevitable is a very strong word to use, but they knew that there was the great likelihood of this, the ocean levels rising, all this other stuff. And that was actually something that, as you're saying, it was just sort of the hypocrisy there and the cold, just sort of the cold calculating character of what they were doing, where it was sort of like outrageous about what they were saying about give the third world a chance to develop, as you know, as we've seen the third world, when oil has been taken from the third world, it's just been remarkable how quickly the people have developed there, right? You know, give me a break, man. But this idea of actually they're taking care of their business, they're making sure that they can actually do this. And they operated, everything came from within that, the parameters of sort of what's best for our corporate interests and our profit margin. That was something that was just really stood out in this.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, you know, ExxonMobil is this gigantic successful company because it has invested so much in their upstream operations, which include, you know, exploration and infrastructure development around production. When we got into this investigation, that was sort of, that to me seemed, okay, here's Exxon, these are the smartest guys in the room. There is no way they could have heard about climate change and not thought about how this could affect things like sea level rise on their oil platforms or storm surge and hurricanes on their onshore infrastructure. They must have at least considered this, if not actually incorporating it. And so when we did start going into this, it was amazing and eye-opening to see that indeed they had done all of this. And, you know, what we were able to do was to sort of juxtapose at the same exact time that they were incorporating this stuff into their engineering designs. Like, within the same year, they were funding campaigns or putting out advertisements that were saying, again, there may not be anything here, so let's not do anything that could, again, affect the consumer, but also affect our company. So, yeah, that was quite stark.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, one other thing here is that on this subject, because as time has gone on, a lot of what was being predicted around what would happen with this has come true. I mean, and especially if you look at what's going on in the Arctic and how just devastated that whole region is in terms of the impact of global warming and whatnot. And even there, this thing about strategically how ExxonMobil and all these other companies were actually looking at this, and ExxonMobil in particular, because that's what you were working on, they were actually looking at these things of how they could deal with it. What they studied, you know, was sort of would their infrastructure stand up under this and what it would open up for them, how they would actually be able to, you know, it was sort of like, well, yes, it's bad for the planet, but could be good for business, which was sort of, you know, and it wasn't like sort of it's bad for the planet, maybe we should hold off. It was sort of, well, it'll give us access to greater oil fields, greater sources of oil. It'll be easier to get in there. There won't be the fact that there's a longer warm weather period or no ice period is actually beneficial for the oil industry. This kind of approach really became prevalent in a lot of this, right?
So in our first story, we looked at the company Imperial, which is an Exxon subsidiary in Canada. And what we found there was that during the early 1990s, again, you know, as the Global Climate Coalition was gearing up for Kyoto, after the policy shift that we documented, the Imperial brand was looking at, considering global warming is happening, right? And we even have an engineer who got up in front of a group of regulators and other engineers who said, you know, nobody doubts global warming is happening. How is this going to affect the company as we go into the next 30 or 40 years? And so it was interesting. They found that there were going to be positives, right? So Arctic sea ice would diminish. It would lead to a longer production and exploration season, reducing production and exploration costs by 30 to 50%, I think was the number that was given. But at the same time, it was going to pose some problems, which included like thawing permafrost and therefore buckling pipelines or, you know, infrastructure that could be negatively impacted as a result of, you know, permafrost thawing. We talked to a guy who was contracted by the company. He's an academic who was also looking at how this would affect roads. It wouldn't be good for transportation on land. So, again, sort of getting back to this, you know, this is a company that invests in its forward thinking, and so they did. They incorporated, you know, both positives and negatives of climate change and the effects that would have on the company and its you know, future decisions in production and exploration and transportation, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one more big question here, and then maybe a couple questions to come off of this, which is, you led this project, this investigation, and you produced something really important, you know, in terms of people all over the world and people really understanding what was going on here, beginning to see sort of what are the real relations in society. You also came under some pretty severe attack because of this. Can you tell people about that?
So I'm actually really reluctant to discuss that. I think what's out there right now is ExxonMobil's letter to the president of Columbia University, which, you know, asked a lot of questions about our reporting. And then the dean of the journalism school wrote a letter back, which went through all of their accusations point by point and, you know, showed that what they were saying was not true and completely inaccurate. And I think I just kind of want to, like, leave it there.
That's fine. That's fine. I just wanted people to understand that actually there was a, you know, it wasn't like somebody said, oh, well, we welcome this investigation, da-da-da-da, but it was actually, wait a minute, there was an attack that came down. And I think it's important for people to realize that when you're telling the truth, it's not always sort of everybody embracing, you know, that the people go, oh, what were we thinking? You know, the people that you're exposing. But actually, it's important that people have the, not just the courage to do this kind of investigation, but also the people in the world have the knowledge they need to actually stand up and defend people like yourself when they come under attack. Because this is a very heavy thing, and it says a lot about how are you going to deal with one of the most life-threatening, one of the most planet-threatening things in the world now. And there's way too much, you know, conference after conference and all this stuff. There's way too much of this idea of we don't really have to worry about it. We don't really, and as people generally in society are saying, no, they're coming to understand the real dangers here. There's still not that kind of sense of urgency. I mean, you look at Jim Hansen, and it's interesting when you were talking about him and his role, his speaking out all along the way. And when he has this assessment of the latest meeting in Paris on climate, he's not getting a whole lot of coverage around this when he said, this is terrible. They haven't done anything. We're still plummeting down the highway. You know, it's sort of like this is bad news for the human race and for the planet. And so I think it's really important that people, when people like you do step out and do this, that other people have your back. So that's all I wanted to say on that.
All right.
Okay. Okay. And you can say, oh, no, leave us alone. No, but it is important. So anyway, Suzanne, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And is there any way, are you going to be continuing to do this coverage or is there more coming or what?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the great advantages to where I work and to the dean of the journalism school, Steve Call, is that he came up with this idea of a project. And so we have, it's a 3-year project, so we've got a lot more to do.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we look forward to it. And I look forward to having you back. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for taking the time and talking to me.
Sure. All right. We've just been talking with Suzanne Rust. Suzanne is the project director of the Energy and Environmental Reporting Project at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. And she has been working with the School of Journalism and the LA Times to produce a series of articles laying bare ExxonMobil's insane and just outrageously, outrageously backward and reactionary pursuit of profit before the safety of the planet. In other words, they were hotly pursuing their drilling of oil and they're releasing all kinds of carbon dioxide into the air. despite the fact that they knew all along that this was going to have disastrous effects for global warming. And as we leave this portion of today's show, I just want to remind people that when you're looking at this, you should always ask yourself this one big question. When you're looking at a problem as immense as what we've been talking about with ExxonMobil, and it's trying to hide the dangers of carbon dioxide in the air, trying to hide the impact of what they're drilling for oil in the Arctic and other places is having on the planet. Well, when you look at this, you should always think, okay, now we're looking at it and we know that we understand that this is a huge problem. It could mean massive suffering and death for humans, for thousands of species, and frankly, for the planet itself. And when you're faced with a situation like that, you always have to be pretty sober and sit back and say, okay, what mode of production, what way of society producing the things that we need to stay alive, distributing the things that we need to stay alive, what mode of production could actually deal with this problem once it developed, or actually even prevent it from developing? But once it's developed, which mode of production is actually able to deal with this? And guess what? The answer is not capitalism, a system that, as we've talked about in the interview, was only interested in chasing after the highest rate of profit and goddamn humanity and goddamn the planet. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Orpheus Reed, yet another writer on the destruction of the planet by the same system. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Orlando Julius with the Heliocentrics, and the piece was Be Counted. Since October 23rd, 2015, massive amounts of natural gas have been spewing from a broken well at Southern California Gas Company's Aliso Canyon gas storage fields near Porter Ranch, which is just on the outskirts of Los Angeles. Now, this gas eruption can't be seen by the human eye, but infrared cameras show it as a huge plume pouring into the sky, and the Environmental Defense Fund has called Aliso Canyon a mega leak and said the plume is about 1,000 feet high and several miles long. Joining us to talk about this today is Orpheus Reed. Orpheus is a writer for Revolution Newspaper at revcom.us. He recently wrote an article entitled Porter Ranch Gas Disaster and the Poisonous Lies of the System. So, Orpheus, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be here, Michael. Thank you.
Sure. All right, Orpheus, what the hell is going on at Porter Ranch?
Well, I mean, basically, as you said, this gas leak started October 23rd, so it's been going on for several months, and it really is a massive, massive disaster. I mean, some people are calling this the largest environmental disaster since the BP Gulf oil spill back in 2010. So, and it definitely is a huge thing. It's had a huge effect down there in Porter Ranch, which you probably have been reading about and hearing about. People have been sickened down there. People are forced to leave their homes. I think it's now something like 3,000 people have been relocated, and there's thousands more that are waiting to be relocated because people are getting sick in all kinds of different ways. Their kids are getting sick. Their pets are getting sick, you know, causing all kinds of problems for them. And then on top of that, it's really a massive climate disaster as well, because the main component of this natural gas is methane, which is a very potent greenhouse gas, more potent than carbon dioxide. So it's really contributing tremendously. I think the thing I read was something like one quarter of all of the methane emissions in California now are caused by this one leak that's going on. So it's really a huge disaster in process. And then SoCal, the company, is saying that it will take them possibly another month or two in order to cut this leak off by drilling a well down underneath where the leak is happening, where the well has actually ruptured, and trying to seal that leak. So, you know, it's kind of a catastrophe in process.
Well, you know, just to add on to this catastrophe in process thing, just at the end of last week, it was really interesting and actually really concerning and kind of, whoa, what the hell is happening now? You know, one of the ways that they were talking about when they were digging this well along the sides, and they said that oh, if they poured enough mud and water down in there that they would actually be able to, you know, stop the gas from coming up out of the top and force it to go into these other pipes. But then what happens is suddenly all that slurry is coming back out, and it's eroded a huge hole around the one big central pipe. And that pipe is actually now loose. It's sort of wiggling all over the place. And they've steadied it by hooking up these wire sort of cables to it and are now like balancing it. But you've got this thing there now that's actually threatening. They said that if that thing blows by itself, if all that gas that they were trying to push down into the ground and into these other safer outlets, as they put it, instead now is going to shoot up in this huge, even bigger plume. And they said that it could be a disastrous. And it's so dangerous that people working there aren't even allowed to bring cell phones because their fear of starting a fire.
Right, right. I mean, methane is very explosive. So, I mean, a number of the things that they have done have either failed or caused more problems, as you're pointing out. I mean, they initially tried shooting a bunch of mud and other things down to try to seal up the leak, and they did that a number of times. I'm not sure if it was four or five times, something like that. And then that led to some of these other problems that have happened. So there is this danger of a couple of things. One, there's the danger of, like you say, just all of the gas kind of shooting up more through the wellhead itself, which would be even a more massive gas leak. And then there's also this danger of explosion. Methane is very flammable. So, you know, if you're in the area, there's a real danger of a fire and explosion happening, as well as the other things that are going on, people being sickened by this, which has been, I think, really covered up and lied about, kind of the danger of it in terms of the effect on people in Porter Ranch.
Let's talk about that. What is that?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things. I mean, people down there probably have heard about this. People have been reporting headaches, nosebleeds, nausea, different kind of breathing problems. People have been vomiting. You know, other symptoms. One woman that I read about said it's like a fog in your brain. It feels like you're having a stroke. And people are having this experience where they're in their houses and they're getting sick, and then they see that when they leave their houses and they leave the area, they feel much better. And for long periods of time, people didn't even know what was causing that. They didn't even know the gas leak was a thing causing that. Parents are saying that their kids have like cold and flu-like symptoms. There's been reports of increasing problems with asthma. And nothing is coming out. This is not being treated like a real serious health emergency on the part of not just SoCal, but all of the authorities down in that region, the entire system, in fact. And it's just been consistently a thing of, oh, you don't have to worry about it because methane is not, you know, is not toxic. And the only thing you're getting sick from is they put these chemicals in the gas, mercaptans they call them. They put those in there so that you can smell gas when it leaks, right? Because methane has no smell. So they put that in there so people can detect the leak, and they say that, well, this is the stuff that's causing nosebleeds and nausea, and these chemicals can cause those kinds of things. But it's not really clear because methane, despite the fact that they're saying it's not dangerous, well, if you actually look up the effects of methane with the National Institute of Health, at high concentrations at least, and, you know, it's not clear what the actual concentrations are at different places in Porter Ranch and inside people's homes, et cetera, but at high concentrations, especially in confined spaces, methane gas can actually displace the oxygen in your lungs, and it can cause loss of consciousness, dizziness, and a lot of these other symptoms that are very similar to what people are reporting. So, you know, and then the long-term health effects of methane are, I mean, I read some different things on it, and the general thing is people say, well, long-term it's not really damaging, but it also is not very well studied, and so there's some debate about that. And then on top of that, besides the methane and these other chemicals that are in there, they've also been finding this you know, people were like walking around and finding this brown residue different parts of the neighborhood, right? And so people were like, well, what the hell is that? You know, then it came out later. It was not admitted at first, but that the gas is mixed in with oil. So part of what's coming out is this oil, which, you know, has hydrocarbons, which actually are damaging to health to inhale and also can be carcinogenic. So you also have benzene that's been detected, and SoCal understated the number of times that benzene had actually been detected. So we don't really know the level of exposure that some of the residents have faced from these things yet. It doesn't seem like it's really been studied and really been covered up.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show. We're talking today with Orpheus Reed. Orpheus is a writer for the website revcom.us and the paper Revolution newspaper. And we're talking about the catastrophe at Porter Ranch. And it's actually a criminal catastrophe, it would seem. Orpheus, tell me this. How has all this happened? You say in your article, you say that it has the fingerprints of the system all over it. And I thought that was something that I thought we should get into, because it's sort of, people don't think of it that way. It's sort of like, well, it was an accident. You know, who knew it could happen?
Right.
It could have been, you know, it was just a thing that happened. You know, you can't control that.
Right, right. Yeah, and there's many ways that it really is the case that the whole system is behind us, and further that the whole system is really incapable of dealing with these problems. I mean, one thing is you just look at time after time after time, right? Oil and gas pipeline spills, as well as other environmental disasters. I mean, you had the whole spill not that long ago down in Santa Barbara, right, which came out was with Plains All American Pipeline, a spill of oil, and they had not put an automatic shutoff valve on it. In this case, in Porter Ranch, they neglected to put a basic safety valve that would have cut off the flow of oil. And this has been there since 1979. They took this safety valve off, which would have prevented it. And basically the logic was, well, it's not really required. It's not really required by any kind of regulations. We couldn't find a new part that was right for it, so we didn't do anything about it. So there's those kinds of things. And then there's also just the question of kind of this whole infrastructure of pipelines that exist in this country. There's something like 2.5 million miles of gas and oil pipelines in this country. I mean, I looked into this a little bit when I wrote on the Santa Barbara oil spill that happened this past year, too. And there's been something like 600 oil and gas pipeline leaks in California since 1986. And these things have caused like millions and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars damages, as well as 200 injuries, something like 50 deaths of people, right? So you have this situation. One of the biggest things is that more than half of the country's pipelines are at least 50 years old, right? So you have all these pipelines that are buried underground. Some of them were 50 years old, or some of them even older. And basically there's this whole problem, this kind of growing problem of corrosion and leaks and different kinds of things going on. And there's really nothing being done about this, because it would require so much investment from capital into this whole situation to rip all these out and put everything in new, or to deal with all the ways things leak, all the safety valve problems, et cetera. So you really have a situation where it's not really profitable for capitalism to do this. And so they don't do it, and they don't require it. And then you only hear about it when there's a disaster, and then they say, oh, we're going to change everything. You know, we're going to have new regulations. Brown calls for a state of emergency. He was actually in Paris being toasted as a great, you know, a great leader around climate change. And this massive, you know, methane leak is going on at the very same time that he's over there. And it's you know, not even talked about. So there's, I mean, we can get into it more, but there's many, many ways the system really is showing itself is like, not only are these things happening time after time, but really they're incapable of doing anything about it because of the whole way that the setup is structured and the way it's organized.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to that in a minute, but I want to pursue this a little bit more. Like, one thing is actually this gas field, this gas storage facility, this is something that's actually, this is not unique to California, right?
Right, right.
And these kinds of conditions, they exist like that, you think, all over the country?
Well, I think this problem, I mean, this has been pointed out by various people. There's a study that ProPublica did, I think it came out in 2012, that talked about some of these problems of deterioration and corrosion in pipelines. This is something that the National Wildlife Federation has been talking about, et cetera. So, yeah, it's definitely a nationwide problem.
Mm-hmm.
Just one small example is, like, they hardly have anybody, any inspectors, to even look at all these pipelines. Like, there's a certain small percentage that they inspect, and they have a group that's called the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. They have something like 139 inspectors for 2.5 million miles of pipelines. And, you know, the point, I'm not making a point, well, we just need more inspectors, and that's what some people would argue, but it's just part of the whole pattern of things. Of like, it just doesn't really matter very much to them, and that's because it's not really profitable.
Mm-hmm.
Not really how they approach anything, and there's this tremendous competition of all these energy companies and all of capital, actually, to try to cheapen costs and do whatever they can do to beat out competitors. So they don't really consider it part of what they need to do until there's a disaster, and then they do some short-term things, but then we're back to the same situation.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this part of something that you referred to in your article as this disaster being just a concentration of a much larger problem?
Right. Mm-hmm. So, as I say, I mean, we can see all the whole pattern of oil spills. We had the Exxon Valdez spill. We had the Enbridge spill in Kalamazoo River back in 2010 that dumped a whole bunch of tar sands oil into the river, killed a bunch of life there. We had a pipeline rupture in Mayflower, Arkansas. We've had oil spilled into the Yellowstone River twice. We had the Gulf oil disaster, right, the largest oil spill in history. So it's one thing after another like this. And really, another thing that's been pointed out is that this pattern of kind of increasing oil spills is directly in relation. It's getting worse, actually, as U.S. oil production has increased. These pipeline accidents have also increased in step. And the Associated Press did this study showing that the pipeline accidents in the U.S. have gone up something like 60% since 2009. So as these, as the pipelines are expanding, there's this whole huge expansion in oil and gas production in the U.S. under Obama, actually. I mean, 72% increase in oil production under Obama since Obama came in 2008. So much for being the environmental president, right? And as these pipelines and fracking and so forth is expanding, the accidents are increasing as well. And I'm not even talking about all the other kinds of accidents that happen. Shipping, they also ship oil and gas by train, and there's been some really horrific explosions of oil trains and so forth on that front.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I'm thinking about when you're talking about all these accidents, these spills and all whatnot, and leaks and whatnot that have happened all over, it does have to do, I think you referred to this just a minute or so ago, but it does have something to do with, I think a lot to do with, one, just the fact that you have, when you're talking about this being a concentration of a bigger problem, there is this sort of exactly the position that U.S. imperialism is in right now, and the fact that on the one hand, they have this really dilapidated infrastructure, and two, they have the necessity to really pump out as much as they can of this in terms of their actual needs, including, and they're pretty strategic needs for the system, but it's sort of like pushing full speed ahead without any care at all given to looking at even what one of the people said who works on, I can't remember, what's her name? Annalisa Anderle, a field engineer for the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermic Resources, said that they have a beautiful facility at the Aliso project. It's gleaming, and they have great roads and well-marked pipelines. Everything's painted, but below the surface, it's junk, and it seems to be something that's just repetitive all over the place.
Right. Out of sight, out of mind, right? If you can't see it, then we're not going to worry about it. And the thing is, there's really a drive here that's involved. As I said, it would mean really massive capital investment. I mean, they put many of these pipelines in. I mean, there's new ones going in too, right? But many of these are quite old. It would mean massive investment, which would mean huge losses in their profitability and in their competitiveness. And there's really no political structures under this system of capitalism that are going to enforce that. And then they have these, whatever regulations that do exist are paltry, and then they keep making promises about this, but they're not really fundamentally able to do anything about this because of these deeper necessities of the system. Every time this happens, we hear these speeches from various representatives of the system saying that, oh, now we're going to have clean capitalism, we're going to get some more laws, we're going to have a new environmental president. But there's just, I think what people really need to understand and really dig deeper into is there's this whole deeper profit-driven workings of this whole system that's going to continue to generate these disasters, even worse disasters, as we can look at the climate situation, we see that for sure, and bring more suffering to people, bringing things closer and closer to just catastrophe. So, I mean, every time it happens, they kind of go into gear to cover up. First of all, they always cover up what's happening. They always downplay the effects of it. We can see that certainly in Flint with the whole water crisis, how they tried to cover that up. And the fact that people were exposing it, they said, what are you talking about? You don't know what you're talking about, and it's not a problem. And they tried to just steamroll over people. And then when it becomes a larger crisis, then they, feel they have to rush out to try to deal with this emergency, but really they're incapable of it as a system. It's not even just these particular people, but really the system is incapable of doing what's necessary, because it's nothing is based on sort of what the people need, what does the environment need. I mean, we would to have the kind of change we need, we need to move away from even this whole oil and gas infrastructure in the first place, right? Because this is destroying the planet, and that's not in the works, and it's nowhere to be found in terms of how this system's operating.
All right, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Orpheus Reed. Orpheus is a writer for Revolution Newspaper and the website revcom.us, and we're talking about the Porter Ranch, basically the massive gas leak, a climate catastrophe that's actually very important for people to pay attention to, and it's on a par with what happened in the Gulf of Mexico back in 2010. Orpheus, let's jump into something a little bit. Well, it's very much related, all right? Let's talk about this, because we're looking at all this and we're thinking, okay, what's the actual situation? What is it overall, and what can be done? And then a lot of people you want to talk about people getting, you know, confused, or people sort of basically covering their eyes and sort of like pretending that, yes, everything's going to be all right, everything's going to be all right. The Paris Conference on the Environment. And a lot of people have come out of that saying, including people who are actually well known for their opposition to and their exposure of some of these past conferences where the Imperials have basically been sort of openly just sort of standing there naked, and everybody's saying, no, they didn't do anything, and they're saying we did so much. This time they're saying, you know, this is sort of the just be all to end all. It's sort of, we've done everything here. We've actually made a great leap in tackling this climate problem. And what the hell do we have to say about that? Because it's certainly a situation where nothing that they're doing seems to be making any effort to, whether it's something like these gas leaks and the infrastructure breaking down and all the, you know, all the other stuff that's going on, but the idea that global warming, the destruction of the planet in relation to a climatic, a cause. Really, while there's a whole lot of talk of we're doing everything we can, they ain't doing nothing.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not that they're doing nothing. They're not doing anywhere near what needs to be done, and it's not just that they're failing to do it, but they really can't do anything about it on the level that's required. I mean, if we really look at what is required to deal with this emergency in terms of the climate on the planet, we need to, as humanity, we need to move very, very quickly, very, very urgently away from fossil fuels. And the whole, it's like you would have to basically just leave all these capital investments that billions and billions of dollars, trillions of dollars have been invested in these fossil fuel reserves, in all the technology, all the transport, all the machines that burn these fossil fuels. I mean, this is where just like trillions of dollars are invested in this extremely profitable. It's an extremely important way that all these capitalist powers basically use as a weapon in their competition with each other, and they're all vying for these sources of fossil fuels. But that would all need to be left basically in the ground and instantly, and just abandoning all these various sources, all this technology, et cetera. That's really what the climate situation demands. We'd have to, really transform the whole way transportation is done. The airline traffic, everybody in a private car, we'd need to bring forward like environmentally sound and really user-friendly public transportation. The whole way agriculture is done, particularly the development of, kind of like this chemical and pesticide-dependent agriculture that's geared for profit, and it also rests on the labor of exploited people all over the planet. And then there's just like a huge investment in livestock production. This is one of the biggest contributors right now to climate change because of the production of methane, which is, as we said, a very powerful greenhouse gas. So you would need, really to assess what's needed, you would need huge changes and huge transformations in all of these things. And this is nowhere on the table in Paris or anywhere here. And instead, they come up with agreements and they went into this whole thing they made this stated goal of kind of like the goal of these negotiations, the goal of where we're trying to move is to keep global temperature rise well below 2 degrees Celsius, which is like 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. That's their stated goal. And yet none of that, even getting to that goal, is not even on the table. And if all of the commitments that all of these various powers made are actually followed through on, if every single one of them, right, which is quite unlikely, scientists have said this would still lead to a catastrophic temperature rise of something around 3 degrees Celsius or more, right? So it's not even on the table, really. And so they're basically just saying, hey, we need to try to mitigate this. We do have a serious disaster in the works. This is a building catastrophe, right? And basically all of these imperialist powers are saying we need to try to do something about it. We need to try to mitigate it. But they're only capable, really, of approaching it from their own interests and also as part of how they continue to compete with each other, too. So none of it's proceeding from really what needs to be proceeded from, which is the interests of humanity and what the planet really needs. And they can't do that. Their system isn't organized that way. It's not set up that way. And one thing I think is really important to kind of grapple with, this is, you know, something that Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, who's brought forward a whole more scientific framework for communism and also has really brought forward a new synthesis of communism and put that on a more scientific foundation. He's got a new talk out that it's called The Science, the Strategy, the Leadership for an Actual Revolution, and a Radically New Society on the Road to Real Emancipation. And this is really something people should check out and go online at revcom.us to read. But one of the points that he raises in this, and he goes back to a lot, is that the mode of production, whatever the mode of production is in a particular society, really sets the foundation and the limits of change. So you have all of these social problems, the oppression of black people, of women, the damage to the environment, and so forth. And these all have their own dynamics and their own, you know, they're all not reducible down to the economic system, but they all take place within that kind of overall framework and the fundamental dynamics of that economic system. And he says, to put it another way, you have an economic system that doesn't prevent you. If you have the kind of change that you need, the kind of revolution to a socialist society, he says, then you have to have an economic system that doesn't prevent you from making those changes, and instead not only allows but provides a favorable foundation for making those changes. And that's what's not possible under this system. Really, that whole mode of production, that whole ownership by private individual interests, the whole basis of it in commodity production, everything to be bought and sold, and everything based on profitability and competition, doesn't allow you to approach things based on the interests of humanity or on the needs of the environment, what the environmental crisis really demands.
All right, Orpheus, one more question. You know, it's very heavy what you've been saying, and I was thinking about reading about the, you know, the Paris conference and the response of different people, and the one really refreshing voice once again was from climate scientist James Hansen, who basically stood up and said, you know, he was just screaming out, "The emperor has no clothes, the emperor has no clothes," you know, and it's sort of, he said, look, this agreement that they came to, it's a fraud, really a fake. It's just bull for them to say we have a 2 degrees Celsius warming target and then try to do a little bit better every 5 years. It's just worthless words. This is no action, just promises. What would you say if you went to talk to Hansen and you said, these are the actions and these aren't actions and promises, empty promises. This is what we need to do.
Well, I mean, I think that he's right in terms of how he's analyzing this agreement. I think he's specifically right in calling this. He said it was bullshit, right? And I think he's correct about that. Now, in terms of what really is required to do that, you know, I agree also that Hansen has been a really, you know, a fearless voice. And I think one of the things about him is that he starts from reality. He looks at the reality of the climate crisis, and then he says, this is what we need to do in order to actually stop it, or this is the amount of change we need in terms of limiting production of fossil fuels and their burning and so forth. So that's very correct. I mean, he does see it as that you can do this within the system. And I would want to struggle with him around what really this system requires and really what the whole basis of this point about the mode of production that I'm raising is, of like that the system is not really capable and we need a rupturing from this system. There actually is a way out through revolution. There is a whole socialist society. There's a foundation in this new constitution for a revolution in this country that provides foundation in terms of humanity really being emancipated, but also taking care of the planet. So there is a way that we could go on it, but it's not going to really happen under this system. But I think also we have to unite with everybody who really is calling these things out and work together and to struggle to stop the damage and the criminality of this system together. But there does have to also be really a looking at what is it going to take, because we're in an emergency situation, and a very urgent situation. So people got to really get clear on what we're up against and what it's going to take to break out of this situation.
All right, Orpheus Reed, thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Okay, thanks a lot, man.
All right, and we'll talk to you again soon, all right?
Okay.
All right, take care, man. Bye.
Bye.
And just one more thing in relation to Bob Avakian's new book that's called The Science, The Strategy, The Leadership for an Actual Revolution and a Radically New Society on the Road to Real Emancipation. You can go to the website revcom.us and you can download a PDF of the book in its entirety and start reading now. I'm telling you, folks, it'll blow your mind. If you've ever wondered about, do we ever have a possibility, a chance of getting out from under this monster, read this book. It's going to just raise your sights, raise your heart, and fill you with a revolutionary understanding and a zeal to stand up and stop this insanity, this criminal insanity. All right, so go to revcom.us and you can download a PDF version of the book before the book itself comes out, and then pick up the book later and spread it around to all of your friends. All right, and one more thing, also new on revcom.us, there's 6 historic resolutions from the Revolutionary Communist Party USA. And those resolutions are all about Bob Avakian, what he's done in the world, why it's important for people to know about him and support him, and actually, how has he actually made it possible for humanity to get beyond this horror that we live in right now? All right, and what's so important about the work that he's done? And no matter where you are in the country, you're going to be able to find some place in your area to discuss these resolutions. All right, I'm certain of that. So this is an invitation to the revolution. Answer it now. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my intern, Alex Brenner, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with one of my favorite songs, First We Take Manhattan, from Leonard Cohen. Talk to you again next week.
Of boredom for trying to change the system from within. I'm coming now, I'm coming to reward them. First, we take Manhattan, then we take Berlin.